My name is Professor Maggie Abernethy. I'm Dean of the Faculty of Business and Economics, and it is my great pleasure to welcome you to the University of Melbourne this evening. And in doing so, I would like to acknowledge the Wurundjeri people, who are the traditional custodians of this land. I'd also like to pay respect to the elders, both past and present, of the Kulin Nation, and extend that respect to other Indigenous Australians present. It's a great honour for the University to host the 21st in this national forum series called One Just World. And indeed tonight has attracted more people than any other forum. One Just World is sponsored by the Australian Government, International Development Agency, AusAid, in partnership with International Women's Development Agency and World Vision Australia. These organisations in every city around Melbourne join one university, and it is a privilege that the University of Melbourne is their partner tonight. One Just World is about providing a platform for ideas and conversations about important development issues and how these might be addressed, to enable you in the audience to talk directly with those involved in development, make your own suggestions, and to find out more about ways in which you can get involved. Now, we all know that our newspapers, TVs, and radio regularly report on global poverty. We're all concerned and appalled at the shocking images that confront us daily. But sometimes we think of those issues as out there or over there, and somehow removed from us and our lives in Australia. Our speakers tonight, and we're honoured to have such a great group of individuals, are going to challenge us as individuals to reflect on our own personal obligations as individual Australians towards the global poor. I expect some very interesting discussion and debate. And of course, we're going to have the marvelous Robin Archer to moderate us. She was even organizing us not 10 minutes ago. As a singer, writer, director, artistic director, and public advocate for the arts, Robin is truly an Australian arts icon. Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Robin Archer.
Thanks very much, Margaret, and thank you for your paying of respects to the elders. I'm sure we all share that sentiment this evening. We do have a fantastic group of speakers this evening, and I'd like to introduce each one. The Ira W. De Camp Professor of Bioethics in the Centre for Human Values at Princeton University, Laureate Professor in the University of Melbourne Centre for Applied Philosophy and Public Ethics, the author of several books on ethics, including the seminal Animal Liberation, Democracy and Disobedience, and the latest and relevant this evening, The Life You Can Save, ladies and gentlemen, Peter Singer. Development expert and senior lecturer in social sciences at the Fiji National University, she's been a consultant with a number of development agencies such as the WHO, UNDP, Pacific Centre, International Women's Development Agency, UNIFEM and Oxfam, and is also a founding member of the Third World Feminist Network, Development Alternatives with Women for a New Era, Dawn. This is Claire Slatter. The Executive Director of the free market think tank, the Institute of Public Affairs, was previously the Executive Director of the Menzies Research Centre in Canberra. He's been a Senior Advisor and Chief of Staff to Federal and State Education Ministers and was the Manager of Government and Corporate Affairs for a global mining company. His fortnightly column appears in the Australian Financial Review, John Roskam. And on my left, if that's believable, the CEO of World Vision Australia, one of Australia's leading voices on social justice issues. He's taken a prominent role, as you know, in national debates on issues such as gambling, urban poverty, homelessness, reconciliation and substance abuse, and took a lead role in Australia's response to the 2004 tsunami. Tim Costello. The Associate Professor in the Economics Department here at Melbourne University, Director of the Asian Economic Centre and Research Associate at the Research School of Pacific and Asian Studies at the ANU. She has worked for the World Bank, the Asian Development Bank, the ILO, UNICEF and AusAid. Lisa Cameron. And last but not least, and to the very left, the... the current Parliamentary Secretary for International Development Assistance has held several key posts in his long parliamentary career, including Manager of Government Business in the Senate. He was a great Minister for the Arts and Administrative Services and was a Cabinet Member in the Keating Government. Recently, to our great sorrow, he's announced that he will retire from Parliament at the next election. We know he'll be sorely missed by the development sector in government, but we know we haven't seen the last of him here. Ladies and gentlemen, Bob McMullen. So it's a huge panel. There's lots of ideas here. But before we start, I understand that we have a short DVD from AusAid called Australia Gives Aid. And that will put you a little bit in the picture of what the nation does for aid abroad.
Thank you.
we'd like to start with is a very brief 2 minutes, if it's possible, position from each of the speakers today on where we stand on global aid from an Australian perspective. I'm going to start with Peter.
Thank you, Robin. Well, I've argued in my book and elsewhere that nations as affluent as we are have a moral obligation to give, that we can't regard ourselves as ethically decent people unless we're giving something reasonably significant to help people in extreme poverty. If we have so much to spare, we have all sorts of luxuries that we spend money on without thinking twice. There are over 1 billion people in the world in desperate need. There are, according to UNICEF, something like 25,000 children who die every day from avoidable poverty-related causes. We could and should be doing something about those deaths, and it's not only the deaths of children, but trying to give people essentially a decent life, a minimally decent human existence, is something that we can contribute to. So I think that's what we ought to be doing. Now, there's a further question as to whether we ought to be doing that through our taxes, through government, or through our individual donations. I think you could argue that if our government were giving enough, then maybe that would relieve us of any further responsibility. But I don't think our government is giving enough. In fairness, I don't think any government in the world is giving enough. But there are some governments that give approximately 3 times as much in proportion to their national income as Australia does. And I think we should at least be up there with them. So I think we do have a long way to go in terms of contributing as a nation. And I think in the meantime, we can do something about it. Of course, we can write to our MPs and tell them that we think the foreign aid should be increased. We should match the levels of Sweden and Denmark and Norway and so on. We should also tell them to make sure that it's as effective as possible. That's another important thing that this government is trying to do something about. If they're not responsive, or in the meantime, while we wait for them to be responsive, I think there's absolutely no excuse for not reaching for our checkbooks or credit cards, going online, whatever it is, and giving to one of the many effective agencies that we have in this country that are helping to relieve poverty elsewhere in the world.
Claire.
I think we all have a responsibility to ask questions about the societies we live in, about the distribution of wealth and other resources within them, and about whether domestic or foreign policies, which include aid policies, are fair and just, and how we might contribute as individual concerned citizens to changing laws, policies and practices in pursuit of a fairer and more just, or fairer and more just relations. In other words, I think that there's a role for us to play as mindful, concerned citizens. As citizens of a first world nation, and I feel a little bit, tentative about suggesting things to Australians. I'm not Australian, but as citizens of a first world nation, I'd argue that individual Australians also have a responsibility to hold their governments accountable for the international commitments they've made to reducing global poverty, for how Australian ODA, which is public money, is spent or is being used, and for any impoverishing effects of official aid policies in recipient countries. Almost 40 years ago, developed countries, including Australia, pledged to raise their level of aid to 0.7% of national income. At the end of 2008, which is when we have the last available statistics, the level of aid by donor country stood at just 0.31%, the same as it was in 1992, and less than half of the promised 0.7%. I don't know what Australia's level of aid is at this moment, but it seems to me to be well below 0.7%. And it seems that the 0.7% commitment has all but been forgotten by many OECD countries in the context of the new aid modalities, which have been inspired by the Paris Declaration on aid effectiveness. And so we're looking at today an estimated 11.4 billion people living under the new poverty line of $1.25 a day, a majority of whom are women. And despite assertions to the contrary, most NGOs, which have been monitoring this, say that there's been very little progress in the fight against global poverty.
Thanks, Claire. John? 2 minutes?
Oh, 30 seconds. I think we get too hung up on decimal points in relation to aid. I think we owe the rest of the world, whether they're rich or poor, a couple of things. We owe them respect. We owe them the truth that relief and aid is divided into a couple of categories. I think there's disaster and emergency aid, which we as Australians and as governments and as individuals, we can contribute to. But then I think there's the other question about development. And certainly aid has a role in that, absolutely. But from my perspective and from the perspective of the Institute of Public Affairs, trade, barriers to trade, protection are ultimately the issues that are going to provide longer-term sustainable development. And I think we owe others the truth to say that aid is only going to be part of the way forward. It's not a solution. Whether we can ever find a solution is, I think, a separate question. But when we're talking about aid and development, certainly I'm happy to increase the Australian aid budget. But I think a bigger difference can be made by governments promoting free trade, development, economic development to ultimately give others the opportunities that we've had.
Tim.
Well, this is scary. I'm agreeing with John here. not much of a debate, really. I just want to say, since Bob is finishing up at the next election, and he may not thank me for breaking the Official Secrets Act, but in terms of the aid debate, we've had a minister here who really has had this issue passionately on his radar. He'd quietly ring me and say, keep the pressure on us for 0.7. We're not doing enough. And it's a minister of the present government. And just publicly, I want to thank you, Bob, for your passion. When Bob spoke to our staff after the Rudd government election, people said to me, you sounded like a politician and he sounded like the activist. it's an interesting one. I think it's great that what John has said from the APA, aid was at its highest under Menzies. It actually got cut to its lowest under Hawke. So aid isn't simply a right-left issue. There is, I think, the need for bipartisanship, and thankfully Barnaby Joyce has given us that by what he did last week. So in terms of us doing better, I think Australians have more than just an ethical duty, and Peter has brilliantly in his book really said the ethical duty is clear. We'd all save a life of someone immediately near us. Why is the ethic diluted if it's someone whose life we can save just because they're a bit further away? That ethical principle, and then Peter really summarising what the cost of saving a life is, I think is the powerful ethical argument. The other argument I'd put is, of all regions, Australia has the most self-interest to also being responsible for the global poor. They are in our region. They're a long way from Europe. They're a long way from America. And it's this region, particularly, I guess, the Chinas and Indias, but also the Cambodias and Vietnams, who have smoothed the pillow of our troubles in the economic crisis. We didn't go into recession, and Bob will give us political reasons, but we also know it's because in this region, our neighbours were buying our goods, and this is one of the most enlightened self-interest reasons why, in addition to ethics, we should be taking the poor seriously.
Thanks, Tim. Lisa. Okay.
That's my brother.
Oh, no!
Well, it seems like we're all agreeing. So, yes, I think that Australia and Australians should give generously to foreign aid. I don't see this as a debt or a reciprocation for our high standards of living, but I just think it's something that a fair and decent nation should do. Now, as the economist on the panel, I thought I'd try and give the question a bit of economic framework. So contrary to popular opinion, economics is not the study of money, it is the study of happiness. And the little bit of PR there. And the economic model that underlies a lot of economic analysis is that of utility maximization, where you have individuals attempting to maximize their utility or their happiness subject to constraints, where the constraints are normally something to do with income or time. And so there's a vast empirical literature in economics looking at happiness and what determines happiness. And it shows pretty conclusively that there's not much return to extra dollars in developed countries in terms of happiness, whereas there is a large return in developing countries, which just goes to show that at relatively little cost to our welfare or happiness, we can make a rather significant contribution to the welfare of developing countries.
Thanks, Lisa. Bob.
Well, thank you very much. Just like tax is the price we pay for living in a civilised society, development assistance is the price we pay for living in what we hope to be a civilised world. It is our obligation in the sense of we have the good fortune to live in an affluent country, and we should have an obligation to assist those who don't share that fortune. I just want to add one extra element, rather than just all agreeing with each other. Clearly, I'm an advocate of increasing the development assistance budget, and I'm in the process of presiding over an increase that many of you think is too slow, but is proceeding significantly and will continue at least for the next 5 years. We are, and I agree with John and Tim, that for most people in most developing countries, most of the time, an opportunity to sell something to us is more important than our aid. A trade, no country ever got out of poverty by aid alone. It's a necessary part of it, but it's not sufficient, so we have to do something about trade. I want to add a third element. In the 21st century, the question we're going to have to deal with also is about migration, temporary and permanent. The transfer of skills and people temporarily and permanently from developing countries to developed countries, and it's a difficult political issue at both ends of that equation. But for individuals, for countries, for us all, that is a question we're going to have to come to terms with, and the sort of old-fashioned idea that somehow or other it's a brain drain and we shouldn't allow people with skills to come here, or that we don't have an obligation to create skills at the other end is, I think, passé, and it's time we moved on. So I think that is a new element we have to look at. It's harder at both ends, but it's important. And I just think we owe them also, and I'll say this briefly because others have said it, efficiency and effectiveness, so that we get the best result for the money we spend, and so we can maintain the support in Australia to keep spending it. And we owe them, I think, priority on the things that are most needed or most effective. The research is very clear that the most effective investment in development is educating girls, so we need to make sure that maintains a focus. It's easy to take your eye off that because there's so many important things to do. And it's also clear that the most disadvantaged people in the world are people in developing countries with disabilities, and they have not been sufficiently at the centre of the global aid debate, and the Australian government is trying very hard to put it there. So those are, I think, the building blocks for what an Australian strategy about doing something about global poverty might look like. Thank you.
Thanks very much, Bob. Claire, is there a need for more research in the Pacific region in particular?
While one can say that, you know, specific aid monies and aid projects are having some impact, often one sees Department of Trade, for instance, and the ODA arm of the Australian government or any other government working across purposes. And I say this because I think that the push for liberalisation of trade, and I know that I'm taking a position very different from John, you know, does have impacts which are negative in our part of the world particularly. Opening up our economies to trade is going to have, through, for instance, PACER Plus, is going to have, I would argue, enormous negative impacts. We're going to see industries, domestic industries, collapse, fold up, or whatever, because they won't be able to withstand the competition from the influx of goods from Australia, New Zealand, let's say, and other places. And we'll have people put out of work, and therefore, you know, you see a direct link between contribution to poverty, if you like, or impoverishment. And you have, on the other hand, of course, the aid arm of the Australian government, the AusAid, being very concerned about protecting the poor or, you know, delivering to the neediest in society. So I see, you know, as kind of difficulty with the kind of approach that's taken with Australian policies of foreign policies, if you like, towards the region. And I would say that there needs to be more research into the impact of liberalisation policies. No one's really doing independent research into that. Usually, the kind of research that's commissioned by, for instance, the Pacific Islands Forum Secretariat brings in people who are already advocates of free trade. So I don't consider that to be independent research. And so the findings will say, yes, there are some negative impacts of it, but overall the benefits of free trade. You know, it's assertions all the time about the benefits that will come of free trade, and they fly in the face of, I think, evidence from other countries, in which I'd expect to be seen in the Pacific as well, evidence to be seen in the Pacific as well in time to come.
Yeah, I had the good fortune in December to go and make a small film for the ABC and AusAid about one small bag. It was my first experience in Vanuatu. And I was similarly a little bit taken aback about the level of poverty for some people who were working in the company, for instance, who had no water and electricity but were quite famous soap opera stars that the company runs, and to find Australian real estate in Vanuatu selling the Paradise Dream in the face of that kind of existence. And I was a little bit shocked by that. So, John, what's the position there when you see such huge gaps between what's essentially a free trade experience and the position of people living there?
Look, that's true, but there are huge income disparities outside in Swanston Street. You know, we can see homeless people right now. So for me, it's not the disparity itself. It's about the sustainability of the future. And, you know, certainly free trade advocates like me would say there are absolutely negative aspects to free trade. Free trade and globalisation can be a gigantic tide that washes away community belongings and our anchors to our society. But at the same time, it is free trade and liberalisation that has lifted hundreds of millions of people out of poverty. And for all the difficulties of liberalisation, I can't see any alternative to that compared to a Cuba, a North Korea, or other places. I mean, we talk about the South Pacific, but we had, at the end of the war, Singapore, we had Hong Kong. In the 1960s, South Korea and Ghana had about the same GDP per capita. So, you know, certainly liberalisation is difficult. Certainly there are losers. But I would argue, if we're talking about sustainability for the future, then there's clearly one way forward, which is what the evidence shows us.
And it's certainly what Paul Collier is talking about most recently, about the differentiation in development, which he regards as one of the greatest problems. So, Peter, where does your book talks a lot about individual responsibility and the challenge to live ethically. How does the individual responsibility sit next to these other levels of responsibility, for instance, the governmental level or the corporate level?
Well, obviously, in a democracy, we have a responsibility to be an active, participating citizen. And Tim was saying, Bob was saying, I guess, to put pressure on the government to live up to their pre-election promises and to do better and to raise the level and the effectiveness of the aid they're giving. As consumers, I think we also have a responsibility to be conscious about our consuming choices. And that's complicated. I think, for example, we want to know that where we can, we buy goods from developing countries that support their industries and their activities. So I know when you talk about food, many people are very concerned to buy local and support local producers. And obviously, there are some good things about that. But often agricultural produce are things that developing countries can produce and sell to us. We should be buying them, but if we have available goods that have a fair trade label that indicate to us that the producer, the small producer, gets a decent return for what they're selling, I think we should favour that. I think that's tilting the balance in favour of the small producers and the cooperatives that put these things together. So I think we have responsibilities right across the board with whatever we're doing, whether it's giving, whether it's as citizens, whether it's as consumers, to think about the impact of our choices.
Tim, is that your position? That you've got to act at every level to make this work?
Yeah, I increasingly believe, whether it's poverty or dealing with climate change, that a global ethic is the only way that we are going to make it through the 21st century. And I often say, you get some people sick in Mexico, you close schools here in Melbourne with swine flu. We start to see the profound interdependence with the banking system when, you know, banks with funny names called Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac get into trouble. And banks all around the world are in trouble. We now know, and Bob's touched on this with migration, Obama's touching it on it with the security issues and climate change, that the world is a waterbed. You press down here, it comes up here. So developing a global ethic that says just not eating local food because it's a nationalistic, patriotic thing, but thinking about a fair trade label, looking through, you know, flight miles and those questions and unpicking it, is profoundly important. I'd just say that the trade issue, while I totally agree with John and Bob, people who we help actually don't want aid. They want a job, they want to be able to trade. But the trade issue also must factor in equity issues. Seeing the poor being lifted out of China and India and saying, look at the GDP growth, it's like flying a plane at 50,000 feet. It all looks the same at 50,000 feet. When you actually land and see terrible inequity still in parts of China and poverty in India and elsewhere, and great wealth growing, you then are pushed back to not just a GDP measure, but a human development indicator measure. And it's around longevity and literacy, and it's around security, and it's around gender empowerment. Those issues are equity issues that trade and just trade figures itself isn't enough to look at.
Lisa, is there a gender factor here? In something as dry as economy, as economics, is there a gender factor?
Yes, well, as Bob said, the evidence does overwhelmingly show that the best investment of a dollar in aid is in girls' education. And so by educating girls, then you get educated mothers who educate their daughters, who have the wherewithal to access health services when their children are ill, and so forth. So it leads into this kind of virtuous cycle. So gender is very important. Can I just jump back to the research question? Because as a researcher in the field, and the kind of research I do is it's empirical. It's looking at data collected from millions of households in developing countries where people are asked about their standard of living. They're asked about just day-to-day things in their household. And so I use that data to look at the kind of questions that we're talking about. And I'm not a trade economist, but I have recently been doing some work on trade, looking at the effect of trade liberalisation in Indonesia. And although the economic theory argues that trade is definitively good, and I guess I do believe that, in line with most people on this panel, that opening up countries' international trade is a good thing. When you look at the empirical studies, it becomes a lot murkier, and it's very difficult to get a clear picture as to the impact of trade on poverty, at least in the short term. And I'm doing a study on Indonesia, and we do actually find that trade liberalisation is causing the skill premium to decrease. That means that poorer people's wages are increasing relative to better educated people in Indonesia as a result of trade liberalisation, which is a positive. But also on research and aid effectiveness, I do research where we try and measure the impact of aid. And so you think about how do you go about doing that? It's a very difficult question. And so it's hard to measure the effectiveness of aid. And so there's a big movement around the world currently to run randomised trials, which are somewhat controversial, but where, and I'm involved in one at the moment, where we're looking at the impact of a sanitation program on child health, and we've randomly selected Indonesian villages to get the program and randomly selected other villages not to get the program. And then we look at the effect on child death diarrhea prevalence and anemia and other measures of child health. So I guess I'm just making the point that it's a very difficult thing to measure the effectiveness of aid.
And Peter, one of the things that you raise in your book is the objections that people bring up to giving aid on a personal basis, but also becoming active in arguing to their governments that more aid should be given. And effectiveness is a significant one. That is, people are asking, is what I give actually having an effect? What do you say in that respect when people raise that objection to not getting involved in aid?
Well, they raise it in a whole lot of ways, some of which are really appalling, and I'm sure Tim would be probably heard this, but it is, you know, I've been on talkback radio in Australia where people call up and say, why are you telling me to give money to these aid or agencies? And they'll name World Vision or Oxfam or CARE or one of those and say, you know that only 10 cents in every dollar you give is going to get to the people you need it. You know, they throw this out as if it's a fact that everybody knows. You know, in fact, obviously, every agency needs to spend something in administration, but it's roughly the reverse of that, I think, right? It's roughly 90 cents in every dollar gets to the people who need it, and maybe 10 or 15 cents at most doesn't. But that's still important for running the organisation. So you have to explain that to people, basically, you know, what the basic facts are. That's one thing. Then I think you do have to talk to them about the fact that we can make a difference in various ways, and that there are studies that show effectiveness, and as Lisa just mentioned, they are starting to do some random controlled trials, which are basically the same method that shows that a new drug for heart disease is an improvement over an old drug. And that's the gold standard. It's very hard to do. It's quite costly to do. But it has been done in some cases, and it's shown that some programs work. It's shown that some programs don't work, but that's a learning curve that we've got to go through. So I think that it is important that people hold the agencies up to a high standard, not just of moderate administrative costs, but of actually demonstrating that their aid is making the right kind of difference to the people who need it. And there's various ways of doing that we need to promote and put more effort into doing.
And Claire, how do you ensure the participation of women in these programs? I noticed with great interest this theatre company, which is absolutely incredible, which started off having a clinic that concentrated on HIV, AIDS, but has now introduced pap smears and chlamydia tests and is extending to women's health as well as all other kinds of health issues. How do people manage to keep including women in the picture, or is there something special that has to be done?
I think that there's an increasing awareness of the need to include women, otherwise often development projects fail, as in you're not really reaching the poorest of the poor. How to include them? I think they need to be women in communities need to be consulted and included from the very start, the design of the project, but even before that with a kind of needs assessment, you know, and engaging women in the needs assessment exercise. Often communities in the Pacific are still dominated by men, as you probably know, and when village-level meetings are held, it's men who normally attend the meetings and women are servicing the meetings with tea and so forth. Holding women-only meetings or meetings with the women only in the village, really, you know, separate meetings, clearly needs to be done in order to ensure women's participation. But also making clear and engaging in some kind of public education about the need for women's inclusion in these projects if these projects have to work. So there's a role, I think, to be played in terms of public education by aid agencies. And I think they're already playing this role, but, you know, really just strengthening that approach.
Tim, is there a different approach? I mean, there are different levels of approaches in disaster relief, for instance. I mean, do you have different things for kids, old people, men, women, people in the cities, outlying areas? Is there a differential approach when it comes to disaster relief?
Yeah, there is. And one of the things people in Australia don't really see, because a disaster hits and you see all the different agencies and their brands out there, is the collaboration that happens in a Haiti, in a tsunami area, behind what might be happening in country. And essentially, brought together by the UN, OCHA, you sit down each day, you say Oxfam's doing water, maybe World Vision's doing housing, this group's actually doing food security, you divide up the responsibilities. World Vision will almost certainly do child-friendly spaces, because in disaster, children are at risk and there are malevolent predators that come out in chaos. So you'll know what each is doing. You'll collaborate as much as possible in doing that together. And those differentials really work importantly to say to the donating public, and by the way, just give us a break in terms of how quickly you want all these dollars spent, and are demanding that you should have done it all within 3 months. As we now know here, after the bushfires, you know, a year on with all our infrastructure and political accountability, we still have lots of houses that haven't been rebuilt after 12 months. In Haiti, where you've got the profound question of should Port-au-Prince even be rebuilt on a fault line? And how do you then do it, presuming the government will say, yes, we have to rebuild it, with clear title, with earthquake-resistant places and buildings, is a task of enormous complexity. Now, the agencies and UN and other bilateral governments all have a part to play in that, and there is coordination behind the scene that you may not see in the country where you donate.
Well, given the complexities of aid in almost every aspect that we're talking about today, do you think there is a kind of sense of ownership by Australians about the aid we give, or is it something a bit remote?
We have to be careful that we don't communicate the complexity and lose the essential simplicity. I mean, in most arguments, there's a great complex backdrop, but there is at the core an essential simplicity. And I think Australians get the essential simplicity both of what they do in relation to Tim, who actually runs an incredibly complex and big organisation. But its essential simplicity is it takes in voluntary donations from the public, efficiently administers it and disperses it in both emergency relief and development, and focuses on children and the fight against poverty. That essentially simple. Now, underneath it, there's a lot of complexity. It's the same with us. The fundamental difference is people choose to give him money, we take it. which actually gives us an extra layer of obligation in terms of accountability, because people don't choose to give the government money, and we make the decision about how much of it we spend. Now, they influence it, as Peter's saying, through their democratic pressures on us, but essentially the government makes a decision. We have extra efficiency obligation. But I think people do get the essential simplicity. And the research shows, very encouragingly, that although you can mobilise more resources in donations in response to an emergency, people do get that we need to spend the money on long-term development, just not on emergency relief. That message has got through. The research, AusAid does research every 5 years about community attitudes, and I know World Vision and other big agencies do as well. And we shouldn't underestimate the public's capacity to see the essential good sense of what we're doing.
One of the things that seems to come up a number of times, and again it's something that you've written about, Peter, is the role of environmental concerns in all this. One of the arguments seems to come up regularly: if you go on preserving life and if the life expectancy keeps growing, what's going to happen to all the Earth's resources because they're shrinking? What's the answer to that? I mean, you, but anyone.
Well, just one brief thing to throw in is Bob said earlier, and others have agreed, that educating women is the key to development and to overcoming poverty. It's also the key to giving them control over their fertility, and there's lots of evidence showing that the more years of education a girl gets, the fewer children she is likely to have. There's a correlation. So if we're worried about resources, then underlying that, of course, is population. And while population growth has slowed in some countries, there are still many countries where it's quite rapid, including a lot of poor countries. So I think educating women is an important part of stopping that pressure on resources. But, you know, we also need to encourage sustainable development, which particularly we're conscious of now, means development that's not based on polluting energy sources on coal. And that's a hugely difficult problem. I think, you know, the failure of the Copenhagen meeting shows that we really have not got where we need to on that, and that is going to undermine a lot of efforts over the long term, I think, to reduce poverty.
I mean, I think the environment connects into something that Bob said, and which is a key to the future of the debate, which is population and population movement. And it's always struck me in our debate about aid, and you were asking Robin about what is the Australian's attitude to aid, if someone's knocking on our door, Australians are happy to, you know, often give them $1, $2, but will we let them into our home to share our meals or our beds? And in after the Haiti disaster, there was a very active discussion in America about might not the best form of aid to Haiti be 100,000, 200,000, half a million Haitians into the United States. And so for me, we can have a debate about aid and budgets and decimal points, and that's certainly part of it. But for me, as a rich, prosperous society and country, and my view is Australia can accommodate 40 or 50 million people. Why are we happy just to give people a check and tell them to go away, when in fact a guest worker program, a much bigger migration program is in fact, I would argue, a much better, better, humane, sustainable aid development program, and it's not, then no longer an aid program. But of course that then has huge consequences, because on the one hand, while some would argue for more aid, they at the same time argue for a lower population. And so from a free market think tank, I'm all in favour of the free market of capital and money and goods and services. But exactly as Bob indicated at the beginning, the next debate is the free movement of people.
And Claire, this is about to come up with Tuvalu, Kiribati. I mean, as a country just simply disappears, where do the people go and how many barriers will there be for them simply finding another place? Mm-hmm.
Yes, they will be the world's first ecological refugees. And I think there needs to be really a receptiveness to taking, you know, the Tuvaluan population when that happens. But I'd like to say something too in respect of the constraints or the pressure on resources as a result of population growth. I thought that this debate was actually held in 1992 and UNCED, and where there was a critical view that came out in that really it was a question of overconsumption, overproduction, overconsumption, and that it wasn't so much population, particularly population of southern countries, that was putting the most pressure on resources, but you know the problem of overconsumption, overproduction in the north. And you know there still seems to be that kind of debate today. I mean, my understanding is that the world has enough food, the world has enough resources for the population that exists. It is a question of the inequitable distribution of resources, which is primarily the problem. And you know, that may be a controversial issue and an issue on which we can debate, but you know, it isn't just a question simply of more people meaning more pressure on resources.
Can I just comment on that? I mean, I think it's undoubtedly true the world has enough food. In fact, just the amount of food that we waste by feeding to animals, grains and soybeans that we feed to animals, could nourish everyone in the world perfectly well. But there is a question about the longer-term future, I think, that you cannot deny. I mean, on current projections, countries like Ethiopia, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, are going to double their populations by 2050. Now, they're already very poor countries struggling to sustain those populations. And if you look at Ethiopia, say, there's clear environmental damage due to the population that exists there now. So you do wonder whether, even with the resources we have, we really want to stand by and see those countries continue to have high rates of population growth.
Yeah, Tim.
Yeah, let me just add to that. I think this is a train heading our way, this debate. We're having a population infrastructure debate already in Australia. And we aren't really putting it on the humanitarian ground, and I agree with you on that. We're putting it on economic prosperity grounds, that we need this size to actually compete and maintain our living standard, which is an assumption about consumption levels and a whole range of other questions there. People always say to me, it's overpopulation that leads to poverty. So just tell them to stop having children. And, well, World Vision certainly believes in family planning. I always find myself saying what Peter said, the best contraception is educating girls. For every year you stay in school, you have something like 1.2 less children. But secondly, I think it's really important to say when you deal with poverty, you stop actually having children. if you look at the Singapores and most of the Asian tigers. Therefore, the best way we could deal with both the population and ecological crisis, because it is this train coming, and I think Peter's right, is actually dealing with poverty. It's why making poverty history, and we've been making progress. People often say, oh, yeah, it's idealistic, it's okay for the Irish, Bob and Bono, but they're singers, they're romantics. But, you know, 25 years ago, it was 60,000 kids dying each day. The figure is down to 25,000 kids dying each day. We are making some progress. That needs to be linked to also what it does for population growth if we take making poverty history seriously and the ecological crisis. And these things need to be seen seamlessly together to meet the challenges in this debate.
Lisa, do you see a downside to aid? Do people in the research, do people look at the downsides of aid and what are they?
Well, there is a literature looking at the effect of aid on growth and other aspects of the economy, and it would, I don't believe the literature myself, but because it is very difficult, because, you know, aid is determined by the level of poverty and then poverty is determined by the level of aid, so it's very difficult to separate out those effects. But what that literature does suggest is that once you start contributing beyond a certain, say maybe more than 30% of GDP coming in as aid, which is the case in some Pacific countries, then it does become difficult for the country to administer it, and so that would reduce its effectiveness.
Bob, do you ever get the questions about aid dependency? I mean, just exactly the way Noel Pearson would argue from the Indigenous perspective that there's a downside to growing aid dependency. Do you get that at the foreign level?
Yes, I do. I don't get countries saying, please stop helping. But they do sensibly say, we have to be able to manage this assistance, and please don't all come 1 week after the other from 25 different donors, all coming to see our tiny little Department of Finance, which might have 15 people in it, and you've just used all our resources to entertain visiting Australians and other donors when we'd rather be working to help the country. So, and we have a proliferation. Let me give you a terrific example. A country every Australian wants to help, which is Timor-Leste. And every time anybody in Timor asks any Australian government or NGO for assistance, we all say yes, because we have a passionate commitment to that country because of its history. What happens? There are thousands of little projects going on, and the poor old government is trying to pull it all together with a tiny little nascent finance department. So what we have to do is get more efficient and effective about doing what they want us to do. And talking to them about what their clear priorities are and helping them to implement it. If we do that, then we will get around the aid dependency problem. If we just are generous but unfocused, we can create problems and we can sometimes undermine the purpose that we set out for. But if we say that the priorities, our priority is to do what the country we're working with wants, we will pretty well get around that aid dependency problem. We can't do what every country wants. We do something different in countries like Burma, but in most places, we do what the government wants us to do.
Can I just add something? In that I have wondered about the possibility of aid fatigue amongst people in villages in developing countries, because most of my research is on Indonesia, and I work with a colleague who has worked largely on Latin America. And we were running a survey and we actually asked village heads about the programs in their village. And if you go to Latin America, you might get one or two programs. In Indonesia, we were piloting our survey. It went on for hours, you know, there was this program and that program and the other program. And by the end of it, I did think if I was a poor person living in one of these villages, at some stage I would just feel like saying, go away, you know, and leave me to my own devices. I don't know if that is the case, but I did wonder about that.
One of our World Vision workers who was in Afghanistan said in the village she was in, when they heard the Land Rovers, the four-wheel drives coming, the women would walk out and would draw in the dust the pattern of the village, because they already anticipated the questions they were going to ask. So they would arrive and they'd just point, say, there it is, you know. So, yeah, it is an issue.
So how do you combat aid fatigue? Because you talked a little bit before about the need for coordination.
Yeah.
And a number of people have spoken about that, that in the Haiti crisis or in Hurricane Katrina, there was suddenly a whole heap of other government, NGOs, everybody doing their own bit. Mm. And you've talked about the need for coordination.
Look, there's been a mushrooming of so many wonderfully motivated people who start their own NGO, who made their money and now want to search for significance and have got a foundation and they're going out there. And without wanting to dampen that, there is a need for coordination that actually says if you're working with a community, they need to have control of the terms of this debate. So in our case, it's knowing that we will be there for 15 years, but we're leaving. We're not creating dependency. It's their projects. They set the priorities. They are participating in the design. And if it's becoming too much, it's their lives, after all, and they have to really have the power to define that. But when there's a whole lot of other groups coming in, even when you try and coordinate, people are on a mission, and they're going to help you, even if you may not want to be helped.
Claire, do you think that there's still a tendency to some degree of paternalism in aid? Do you see it?
I suppose yes. It's the framework within which or from which aid givers... I'm not being very coherent here, but the framework from which aid givers proceed, I suppose, is what I'm saying. I don't know that it's a problem for the aid recipient always, but you know, the idea that the aid giver kind of knows what you need can be problematic, and I think sometimes responding to what are what are articulated as needs from the country itself is far better than to come in with a kind of prescription of what a particular country needs based on the aid donor's own, checklist or priorities. Yes, it can be a problem.
And John, do you think that exists in the corporate world? Is there any degree... I mean, first of all, is it widespread that corporate Australia takes an attitude towards aid? Is there a general feel that they need to be good citizens in the global sense? And if so, is there a feeling that, like in most corporate deals, like in sponsorship for the arts, which is the field I know, that you've got to get bang for your buck even when it's an aid program, it's a good citizen role?
Oh, you have to get a bang for your buck. But whether it's corporates, which is my background, or government, it's self-interest, absolutely first. And I don't think there's a conflict necessarily between a corporate developing its brand, looking after its profits, looking after its stakeholders and doing good at the same time. I think the overseas attention of Australian-based corporates, I think, is limited. I think at the moment it's the case that corporates or politicians or others concentrate on one issue at a time, and I think at the moment Indigenous issues, Indigenous education has certainly grabbed corporate's attention, and traineeships and work employment programs have been important, and that's a focus. I think in terms of asking a managing director or CEO of a top 100 company, what can we do for aid? It's about selling my goods, selling my services, and focusing on trade. So I think corporates are not suffering aid fatigue because I think they're a long way away from that space at the moment.
Peter, would you see that as a looking after your own? If corporate Australia is more looking after Indigenous needs in Australia and less in foreign assistance, is that a bit more like the stuff you've expressed, like you look after your family first and those close to you and think about those far away later?
I think we have a tendency to think that we have much stronger obligations and duties to those close to us than to those far away. That's part of our nature, perhaps, and I don't think we'll ever completely overcome it. I'm not saying that we should, but it can sometimes go too far, and I think it goes too far when we are doing something that is not very effective because it's close to us, when we have the opportunity of using the same number of dollars and doing something that would be much more effective further away. So, I'm not going to say there's particular examples of that in terms of what we're doing domestically in Australia, but it certainly can be the case that it costs far less to help people, to lift them out of poverty, to provide them with safe drinking water or something of that sort that they don't have, than it would be to make a comparable difference in the quality of people's lives within Australia.
And Bob, most people who are here and in the overflow room would have a sense of responsibility and would want to take up the ethical challenge of doing the best thing by aid and helping the poor. What can we do in addition to the individual responsibilities to put pressure on the government? As individual citizens, what do we do to get that percentage per capita percentage of aid up? What's your advice to us as individual citizens?
Well, I think the Make Poverty History campaign has been quite effective in focusing the attention of members of parliament on the issue of development assistance as a vote-changing issue for a significant cohort of people. It's not, and in my view, perhaps sadly, but nevertheless, it's never going to be the biggest political issue in Australia. Most people, most times, vote about other things. But what we need to establish, and I think Make Poverty History does it quite well, is that there is a significant, definable cohort of people whose vote intention is influenced by commitments that people make about development assistance. And demanding that both the government and the alternative government make their commitments clear and pressure them to do more. And people individually can go and see their local member of parliament. Much more effective to turn up in the office with yourself or with a group of people than to write a letter. Better to write a letter than to do nothing. Better to sign a petition than to do nothing. An individual letter is better than that. A visit is even better. A visit from a group of you is even better. Have a forum in the electorate and invite people to come along. That will make the candidates... I get them ringing me up saying, I've been invited to a forum, what do I say? Well, that is a terrific question, because there's 226 members of parliament, they all have different priorities. Not everybody's equally passionate about every issue, so they ring up and say, tell me about this issue. They want to know, they go, they listen, they put their point of view forward, they get focused on the question, and they hear people saying to them, this is important to me, and they respond. In the last election, for the first time in my memory, there were a lot of those forums, and a lot of them were in marginal seats, and that focused the attention of a lot of people. And that is significant, and it needs to continue to happen.
Tim, what's your advice? What do you think we, as individuals, what do we need to do?
Yeah, I was just going to say, I don't know how that happened, Bob, in the last election. One of those miracles. What Bob said is really right. Most people who go into politics go in to make a difference. They have a range of issues that they're interested in. And when they see young people in their office, which both Make Poverty History and Michael Challenge did, in marginal electorates, running forums, passionate about these issues, it really is a wake-up call. Because most politicians, when they see a young person, remember that's what they once were like. And they had ideals and they were passionate, and the political process and party system knocks you around and it blunts you. And the freshness of young people saying, we can make a difference, and I've heard this from countless federal politicians, said, well, that really was an emotional wake-up call. So I think those campaigns have been very, very significant. Look, I think it's fantastic that Tony Abbott has confirmed point five, which is bipartisan. Once you got a break in that, like you get a break in immigration issues, ugly things happen in the electorate. A lot of people believe charity begins at home and ends at home. So why would we be given money overseas? So I think that leadership from Tony Abbott was great. I noticed Tony quoting Jesus this morning. the poor you have with you always. As a fellow Jesuit-trained scholar there, John, I'm sure you'll help him with the exegesis.
The poor might might always be with us, but it doesn't mean you can't do something about it.
Exactly, exactly. You don't have a fatalism, and my view is Jesus said that to his disciples because he was saying, you can't follow me without having the poor close to you always. It's impossible. That's the priority. But because of what Barnaby said, and now Tony overruling it, I think it's fantastic we've got bipartisanship locked in, and I think it may have come as a surprise to your side, that bipartisanship, Bob. But I do think it's going to make it very hard to get to point seven. I think that is really, we're going to try, we're going to keep the pressure on, but it's going to be a massive task now.
And why?
Well, we are now seeing a debate really around the size of Australia's debt. Barnaby got the billions and millions mixed up, but that's the debate. And we can't spend over 2% over normal inflation for the next, 15 years to get back into surplus. I think both sides are going to be wanting to prove that they're going to be shrinking the budget just about everywhere. It's not going to be expanding. So I think it's going to be very hard. But as we saw in the last election, and I think, Bob, it's probably the first time in a federal election aid even featured as an electoral issue. It made history in Australian politics. But I think it's going to be hard this time.
I was asking before the debate started, is there a generational difference, Peter? Do you see, in exactly the same way as we'd assume that the environment has come onto a much younger agenda these days, is helping the poor in the same position?
I think there's much more awareness of it now than there was. Yes, I think, obviously these things go in phases, but we are more aware of it, we're more focused on it. We're more concerned to make aid effective than we ever were before. I think someone I know, as Tim said, that Australian aid reached its highest level during the Menzies era. Yes, but during the Cold War period, there was more aid, but a lot of it was given to people like Mobutu in Zaire. Yeah, he may be a corrupt dictator, but he's our dictator, right? He's not a communist dictator. So America was giving him lots of aid, although they knew that a lot of it was going into his Swiss bank accounts. So I think those days are past, fortunately. And we are not, I'm not saying there isn't aid that's politically motivated. There certainly is. America's number one recipient is Iraq at the moment, and number two is Afghanistan. No guesses why. But still, we are more concerned about making aid effective, and we do, I think, have a larger constituency of young people, thanks to Bono and people of that sort, but also a lot of the organisations that are taking that out there and saying this is one of the great moral issues of our time, and I think people do respond to that.
I heard Paul Collier talk at the Battle of the Minds in Battle of Ideas in London a couple of years ago, and he was being fairly ferocious about saying the small-time thing is relatively insignificant when he's an Africa specialist, so doing small things is nothing compared to arguing about corruption in African countries and thinking that we ought to be encouraging our leaders to combat levels of corruption. Claire, do you have an opinion on that, or do you think all of it's important, we should be just doing it at every level we can?
And I think all of it is important, but I think that there are questions issues like corruption that definitely have to be addressed. But I also think, and I think that there's been a shift, I think, in how people have come to understand, like, for instance, their own, role that they can play as individuals and so forth. And this has come with, how do I put this? I mean, there's been a sort of shift in the dominant kind of ways of thinking. I mean, we're now living in a world in which neoliberal thinking is kind of pretty dominant. So people are encouraged to think in terms of individual responsibility, both for your own welfare, but also individual responsibility for changing the world and so forth. And I don't think that in the present context we address at all the sort of structural conditions of poverty, or structural origins or foundations, if you like, of poverty. And, taxation systems have been changed so that, wealthier people are retaining more of their income. The whole sort of ethic of redistribution has gone out the window. And, in this kind of context, I just find it difficult. I mean, I'm reminded of that statement by a Brazilian cardinal, when I give money to the poor or whatever it is, they call me a saint. When I ask why the poor have no food, they call me a communist. And, you know, socialism has become such a dirty word, and any kind of, you know, conception of changing unequal relations within society in a way that smells or whatever of, you know, a kind of socialist approach to justice, you know, is, it's become so, you know, what's the word, demonised or whatever. That it's very hard to put up that alternative kind of perspective to, there are some real structural changes that I would argue really have to be made. Otherwise, not that it's a drop in the ocean, but you're always then going to have these inequalities persisting.
But from my perspective, I'd also argue that socialist countries are the most unequal in the world. But leaving that aside, there's coming back to the point seven argument, there's a couple of reasons why point seven won't be happening in a hurry. One is in our work with young people. You know, certainly we have to talk sometimes in global terms, but nothing is more disempowering than save the world. If everything is a global problem, then how do we as individuals participate in it? So I think there's a real danger in going too big, too often, in too big a hurry. And the other thing about why we won't be reaching point seven immediately is that as much as we laugh about Americans and their lack of knowledge about the rest of the world, Australians have no idea what's happening in the Pacific. I mean, I would argue we have a failed state almost in Papua New Guinea. And if we were to demonstrate what aid could do, what trade could do, what the rule of law could do, what the AFP could do, we would have a much stronger moral argument to demonstrate the good that we can do. And then, of course, when I talk to younger people, as I do, about sending in the AFP into Port Moresby, they say, but John, that's the new colonialism. So I think, you know, we have big challenges that we have to unpack.
Yeah, Bob, do you have a reaction to that?
Yes, I do. I don't think we ought to talk about PNG as a failed state, but
nearly. But
I understand. I'm not particularly disagreeing with John. There is a serious law and order challenge, and development cannot succeed where there's no law and order. People will not invest. People, if you can't, for example, be confident you can get the money from your shop home to your house without getting robbed, you won't run your business. It's not unique to Papua New Guinea, but it's not fashionable to say one prerequisite of development is law and order, but it's true. And we do provide a lot of assistance to PNG in the area of police, but we can only do in other people's countries what they agree with. We can't go in and do things they don't want us to do. And the courts in Papua New Guinea have said we cannot do the sort of policing assistance we provide, for example, in the Solomon Islands. It's not constitutional, so we can't do it. That's it. Whether it was a good idea or a bad idea, it can't be done, because it's their country, and they've made that decision, and we have to do the best we can within that system. That is a proper... That's not a cause of regret. That's a proper thing. It's their country. Well, I've... Not with my support, we didn't.
Yeah.
Go.
About
just general question.
The general question
PNG.
Of Papua New Guinea, or
governance generally.
Governance.
So, well, I guess I was thinking of the structural causes of poverty and how you might address that, and it may not be true of the Pacific, because the Pacific is a special case. But I think trade liberalisation, as unpopular as that may be, does address the structural causes of a lot of poverty. And that's not a band-aid approach in the way that you might view aid being a band-aid approach. But you need aid in to go alongside those kind of policies. Because if you want growth to lead to poverty reduction, then quite a bit of research shows that you really have to provide support for people at the lower end of the income distribution so that they can participate in the growth process through education, health, giving people access, maybe girls access to services and so forth.
We're going to have to wind up fairly soon, so I want to conclude with a small statement from each of the speakers. If we asked what does a just world look like to you, what's the brief answer? Bob, what does a just world look like?
I read recently an article that said the most important factor in determining your life opportunity is where you're born. A just world looks like one in which that's not the case, where it's your skills, your aptitudes and your application that decide your future, not the good fortune of where you're born.
Lisa.
Well, a just world to me is one where everybody has quality of opportunity. That's not a realistic outcome in our lifetimes, but I think through aid, effective use of aid, you can improve the opportunities available to the poor in developing countries, and that's very worthwhile.
Tim.
I agree with Bob. I think the lottery of latitude, we don't choose the stage we're thrown onto, and yet that where we are born determines our destiny. Equally, I think it's development, as Amartya Sen would say, is freedom. It's actually people being able to make their choices. And I was really amazed with a BBC production where some people in the busties, the slums of India, were taken to London and were shocked by the relational poverty in London. And they said, we have to do something about these poor people. So the freedom to name what you think poverty is actually important.
Fantastic. John?
Well, I think it's about a respectful world and an honest world. And I think, you know, Bob is right about what Australian aid can do in countries. And it's the case that often we can do only as much as we are allowed to do. And for someone like me, it is then to ask the question, well, why are we only allowed to do that? And that opens up a whole cornucopia of questions around aid to failing states, aid to totalitarian states, aid to states that are not respectful of human rights, of women, I think is really problematic. And I think we can keep on arguing about margins and moving towards point seven and arguing about, well, maybe we can, you know, convince them, maybe we can bribe them, maybe we can negotiate with them. But I think there are much broader issues around population and about, you know, what our respectful relations are, not just to other governments, but to the people in those countries that we're dealing with.
Claire, what does your just world look like?
My just world, I think, is a world in which inequalities based on class, gender, race and ethnicity and all other such things or social markers has been eradicated, and in which there is, there are equal and fair relations between states.
Peter?
Well, I'll go for something a little more modest, and that is a world in which everybody can, if they apply themselves and work reasonably hard, meet their basic needs and those of their family. I'll settle for that.
It's a good one. This has been the 21st forum in the National One Just World series, which looks at key development issues affecting us as members of a global community. A video of tonight's speakers will be available on the One Just World website shortly. You can watch all the forums in the series. If you've registered tonight or via the website for updates, you'll receive an email whenever a new video is attached to the website. You can also add comments about the issues and suggest ideas for future forums. One Just World is not just about providing an opportunity to hear these interesting perspectives or about stimulating discussion on ideas. It's also thinking about what we can do to help build a more just and equitable future. Please check out the tables in the foyer when you leave for a number of ways in which you can help. And please take a little bit of time to fill in the feedback forms so that the people who put on these events can actually keep doing them better and better. On behalf of the International Women's Development Agency, AusAid, the University of Melbourne and World Vision Australia, thank you very much for coming tonight, and will you please thank our terrific speakers in this country.